step, doesn't it? Coming back onto Zoom. And if you're speaking, you kind of want to get some feel of empathy with your audience. And it's not particularly easy on Zoom to know kind of how you're reacting, whether it's interesting and, you know, but anyway, bear with us. So I've got a bit of a kind of cell icebreaker question to start with. How has this pandemic stretched, test, or strengthened your trust in God? Because I found personally that it has rather stretched my trust in God, particularly when it comes to running a business. And we're getting very much to the sharp end of everything now. We're getting towards the end of October, with a month to go at the end of this month. So I've been kind of looking for some encouragement, and I find the words of Isaiah 40 incredibly so. And I ask Alison if she'd read from Isaiah 40 for us, starting, I think, at verse 12. It's about 10 verses. Is that all right, Alison?
Yep, that's fine. Can everybody hear me? Is that okay? Yep, you can. So Isaiah 40, verses 12 to 25. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has informed him? With whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding? And who taught him in the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it, a goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them and they wither, and the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me, that I would be his equal, says the Holy One?
Thanks very much. I find those words bring us some good news in place of what we hear daily. The passage actually addresses testing times, and the context came when Judah was sliding towards exile for the nation's disobedience to God, and Isaiah had just brought bad news in the previous chapter. Despite King Hezekiah's defeat of Sennacherib and the Assyrian army in chapter 36, another empire, the Babylonian, is coming and will leave Judah's kings with naught. Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left. So bad news. It seems to me we humans are disposed to want bad news before good news. We like our stories to have happy endings rather than sad ones. So Isaiah chapter 39, the bad news, is followed by the one we've read, chapter 40, which is the good news. Now I'm going to try and see if Louise can put the first illustration up on the screen. Here we go. I expect some of the children recognize that. I can't ask you because we're on Zoom, but it's the story of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. This is actually a bad news, good news story. And the bad news was that four of the five children who won the golden ticket to visit Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, that's 80% of them, are greedy. Augustus Gloop, Mike TV, Veruca Salt, and Violet Beauregard. But there is some good news, and I don't know whether the children here can tell me, but you can't obviously, but what is the good news? The one who is not greedy, Charlie, inherits the factory. So good news, bad news. And we say Jesus is good news. Why? Because he provides a solution to the bad news and the consequences of our selfishness when we trust him and take it as his word. There's plenty of bad news to disturb our peace. I don't have to mention it. Climate change, Syria, a flood of brave but desperate refugees, growing levels of persecution of Christians around the world. We see God's will defied, abortion on demand, abuse of children, unrighteous trade, God misrepresented by fundamental atheists and opposed by regimes like North Korea. And on top of all of that, we have to cope with what we face daily, physically and mentally. And what I want to do is just pick out three characteristics of God, which Isaiah highlights in chapter 40, to bring us some good news and encouragement to trust him in our daily challenges. The danger is for me to say categorical, unqualified things about the nature of God, which Isaiah did not intend, but here goes. And the first is God's size. So who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span, calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? How big is God? We absolutely have no idea and can't have any concept because God is so big, we cannot understand how big he is. And the closest we get, really, is a giant giant. Now, think of your favorite giant story. I've got a picture that I hope Louise will show next of a giant. Here we go. Do you recognize him? It's the BFG, and I suspect he's very popular with certainly the children. I don't know what your favorite giant is or favorite giant story. I don't know whether we can have a show of hands. Go back to the screen. Who likes the BFG? Yeah, probably the most popular. What about the giant of Jum? Or perhaps for the elder ones here, Jack and the Beanstalk. Jane likes Jack and the Beanstalk. David and Goliath. I came across an interesting giant called The Selfish Giant. It's a story by Oscar Wilde. And I didn't know he'd written a story about giants, but it's about this giant who refuses to let children play in his garden. And as a result, it's always winter in the garden. And it's a short story, but there's a fantastic redemptive theme in it where this Jesus-like person comes and sets things straight. And I was very surprised that that would come from a person like Oscar Wilde. So do read it. The nearest classical idea we have is the Titan Giant Atlas. Do we have the next one? Here we have Atlas. He was given the task of holding up the universe by Zeus as a punishment. And he stands in the far reaches of the Western world where the Atlas Mountains are named. He's not actually holding up the world as some people think he might be. He's holding up the heavens, but he's standing on the earth. Now, today's stories of giants are fairy tales, but it wasn't so in the ancient world. The Hebrew people knew of them. In Numbers 13, chapter 32, verse 32, we read about them. This is when the spies had gone into the promised land and they came back to give a report. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants." Does that mean it eats them? "And all the people whom we saw are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. We became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." Giants saw humans as we see grasshoppers. Huge difference in size. How does the God of Israel compare? The ancient peoples had premonitions about the true nature of God, but size wasn't one of them. A concept of God being greater than any giant belonged to the Hebrews as someone who stands above the cosmos, not on the earth, who holds the earth together and the universe together rather than support it, unlike poor Atlas. And the good news is, God is bigger than anyone else. Now, I want you to imagine meeting a giant. I'm sure if you met an English giant, he would be polite, he'd be helpful, he might be a bit dense, but he wouldn't devour children. I don't know what it would be like meeting a Himalayan giant. But imagine meeting God. And Isaiah, earlier in this book, has met God. And you know what his reaction when he met God was? He said, "Woe is me." But the good news is God is on our side, like the BFG. The second thing is God's nature. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or has his counselor informed him? With whom did he consult and gave him understanding? Isaiah raises a question: who was big enough to tell God the way to be? Well, no one, of course. Now, a common question is, and I could ask this, I'd like to ask it of Tristan if he was here, but I don't think he is if you could be God for a day, what would you do? Hi, Tristan. If you could be God for a day, what would you do? If we ask that question of most people, they'd probably say, "Oh, we'll do something about poverty, we'll do something about pain and suffering." But I've got a second question to ask generally, is if you were God for a day, who would you be? From the records of the ancient world, most people believed in many gods with a special sphere of geographic or functional influence. They felt no God could possibly take care of the needs of every individual. They got angry, their behavior was consistent and oppressive. They fought each other. We know how wrong they were again. So if you were God, what nature would you take? You could be a vindictive and cruel monster. You could be a dictator. I could say, "Darren, go and invade Abyssinia for me." Or I could say to Lawrence, "Bring me a glass of your best red wine." Or I could say to Anya, "Go pick me some nice red roses for Jane." Or you could be, you could make us into predetermined robots. So, "Yes, Lord, I will worship you. Yes, Lord, I will worship you." But we know what God chose to be. He chose to be love because he's big enough to be so and because it works. And this is good news again. God is the path of justice, as we've read. Third thing is what God thinks about nations and their empires. I don't know which country currently unsettles you the most. It might be the Russians, because they are able to poison their opponents and get away with it with impunity on foreign soil and put towns like Salisbury at risk and even kill some of our citizens. Might be North Korea, because of a possible nuclear conflagration with the states. Or it could be China for its incredible worldly ambitions and threat. But what does God think about nations? They're like a drop from a bucket, regarded as a speck of dust. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beast enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They're regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. And it seems to me every empire has, over history, used an extraordinary conceit to justify its reach. And the self-importance of the largest ever, our British Empire, was the conceit of societal superiority, which unfortunately had a racial expression. White nations had evolved better than non-white, and it's well summarized in Kipling's poem written about 1900 called The White Man's Burden. And I just thought it would be worth showing an illustration of that poem. This is the last one I've got. So you can see this is an illustration of that poem. And it's a picture of Britain leading America up quite a steep mountain. And carrying on its back are peoples of color from all over the world. And it's a difficult journey. They're climbing over these rocks of superstition, oppression, barbarism, ignorance, vice, brutality. Where is it leading up to? This idea at the top of the mountain is Britannic civilization. It's an incredible conceit. Thank you. So, Louise, so the heavenly description of Britain's conceit and its ensuing power, influence, achievements, and abuses would be as Assyria's was in 701 BC, less than nothing. I don't know strictly whether you can have something that's less than nothing, because nothing means non-existence. But I think Isaiah's literally meaning is clear enough. It seems to me God will use empires. God determined the Persian Empire would return the Jews to their homeland in 539 BC. The Roman Empire ushered in a period of peace under Augustus as the known world became globalized around the lifetime of Jesus. And with road networks built, passage across the seas freed from pirates, people like Paul and other disciples could travel quite easily and openly, which allowed Christianity to spread. It was the right moment. And then the British Empire released a huge global missionary movement in its wake. And if we think about the latest empire, which might be China, we have yet to see what millions of fearless Chinese Christians prepared by God might do. So we don't need to fear empires. God puts no values on nations' ambitions, even if he uses their conceit for his purposes. I like the long-term perspective of the poem Ozymandias. And I think 2 weeks ago, Darren, you quoted Gerald Manley Hopkins. So I'm going to quote Shelley. And Paul in Athens also quoted Greek poets. So in sermons, it's not a bad thing to do. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tells that its sculptor well those passions read. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. So dust and decay, not only less than nothing, nations are meaningless to God, they are void. But the good news is, there is one group of people which is utterly meaningful to God, and that's us, his church. This group matters to him. He will nurture, look after it, and bring it to maturity. Empires come, empires go, but not God's kingdom. And Isaiah has already said in chapter 9, of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So good news. Now, most of us here, I suspect, have never known what it's like to be ruled by others, taken into exile, our names changed, for our children to be removed, for our places of worship to be destroyed. And it seems a bit facile for me to say that God's size, his nature, and disregard for the conceits of nations is good news, and we can trust God in such circumstances, where everything will be all right in the face of overwhelming, unsettling existential threats. I've never had to trust these truths in quite such circumstances. And for someone in Hong Kong, where China does mean something to its people and appears to be not less than nothing, it's where the rubber hits the road. And I don't know if my thoughts can help. And we would have to ask Yan Yan if that was the case. But Isaiah is a start and a context, and it lifts our horizons. We're all trusting God in some measure for something. To benefit from the gospel, we took God at his word. And it seems that that's something we should nurture and look after and let grow. One of the things that struck me about scripture is it exhorts us to write things on the tablet of our hearts. It's a strange idea, but a bit like a living epitaph. I don't know whether you've thought about your epitaph when you die, what will be written on your gravestone. You've heard of some funny ones. Spike Milligan's, "I told you I was ill," on his. I thought I would write on mine, "I wish I'd played more cricket." But a bit spurious, what about if you had a spiritual message? Something like, "His heart took God at his word." Now, the problem with epitaphs is they don't do you much good when you're dead. But what about having a living epitaph, something written on your heart that helps you now? Whether going gets tough or gets really tough, how might that strengthen our resilience? So my takeaway from these thoughts is, if you had heart surgery and you were opened up and your heart was exposed, what words would be written across your heart? And if there's anything from this talk, I hope it would be words something like, "He trusted God 100%. Or, "His heart took God at his word 100%. And you can think of your own epitaph that you might want to see written there, but it'll help the bad news be transformed by some good news. So that's my takeaway and my thought this morning. What's written on your heart?